Lecture 11, Melville, Moby Dick, Part 2.
Well, it's not going to be easily possible to wrap up in this second lecture all of my thoughts about Moby Dick, but one thing I can say is that we're going to move from measuring the whale to measuring Ahab, because Ahab is, in fact, modeled after the whale. It's the larger-than-life hero of this text. He represents, I think, a kind of swollen, deified notion of the self. But what is remarkable is that the book is much more than Ahab. He's been inserted in a text that is equally interested in subjectivity and perspective and multiple perspectives and multiple vistas. And this, in a sense, is a collision course between the monomaniacal single viewpoint of obsession on the one hand and a world that has much more scope and diversity to it on the other. Now, the Nantucketeer, as I said in my first lecture on Moby Dick, is presented by Melville as a new kind, rough-hewn, modest, but nonetheless impressive American hero. And Ishmael is also, in a sense, drawn to human scale, but this is not true for Ahab. He is as huge and dimensional as the whale. Actually, Melville's terms are quite wonderful. An ungodly but godlike figure. And his thoughts and his feelings and, in fact, his soliloquies constitute much of what is most dramatic and sort of spellbindingly eloquent about this book. Frequently, he's imaged in terms of sultanism, a term that Melville took from the Middle East, from Arab culture, to signal something of this man's reach. Because even to make an American shipping captain, a whaling captain, a hero equivalent to a king or a prince or a knight is already a fairly important step on Melville's part. He has, as I suggested earlier, in his position as captain of the ship, a kind of remarkable godlike power. And Melville was fascinated with this. As I said, on the one hand, this sort of tweaks our notion of whether this could be very democratic or not. Ships are not democratic places. But beyond that, Melville's fascination extends into the kind of moral and legal questions that go with this. If you've read Billy Budd, you know at the end of his career, Melville came back to this. What happens in a case where a man is going to be convicted of something and the captain knows that ultimately this man is innocent, but he nonetheless broke the rules? And we've got this kind of dilemma of what the captain of a ship is free or not free to do. And in a resplendent Melvillian story, Benito Cereno, we get another kind of inquiry, a kind of really rotating perspective on what it means to be the captain of a ship. So that mattered to Melville. He was very fascinated with the kind of responsibilities, but also perhaps the kind of blind spots that go with being captain. He is the one, of course, who was the candidate for the great Shakespearean soliloquies and for the grand language. You can't miss it. If you open up the book on any page and you get this language that is almost out of this world, it's so gorgeous and rich and sumptuous, you can pretty much assume it's Ahab who's thinking. He, of course, is on a revenge mission. He has lost his leg to Moby Dick, the great white whale. He obviously walks around on an artificial leg. He has been hit at the groin. There are unmistakable echoes of castration that are in this text. And he, therefore, sees in the white whale the very incarnation of evil. And his goal, as he says, is to strike through the mask. This is the revenge scenario. And he suggests, therefore, that this white whale is the incarnation of a spirit that is not just the whale, the spirit of evil that needs to be fought against. This is a problematic sort of position. His first mate, Starbuck, who was a Christian, believes that there is something deeply sinful about regarding this innocent creature as the embodiment of evil. But this is the way Ahab responds to him. All visible objects, man, are but as pasteboard masks. If man will strike, strike through the mask. In other words, the world is just a series of signboards. And what you need to do to exert your own authority is to strike through. It's a very violent kind of model. How can the prisoner reach outside except by thrusting through the wall? It's as if we inhabit a kind of world of thin papier-mâché walls. And if we want to deal with the real forces that course through the world and inform our lives, we have to go through these walls. And he is aware that perhaps the white whale is that wall, and perhaps the white whale is not. Perhaps the white whale represents evil. Perhaps there's nothing behind the whale. It doesn't make any difference, he says. He tasks me. He heaps me, he writes. And he says that that inscrutable thing is chiefly what I hate. And be the white whale agent or be the white whale principal, I will wreak that hate upon him. I'd strike the sun if it insulted me. What a line. I'd strike the sun if it insulted me. Here is the kind of overweening pride. Shakespeare even doesn't have characters who would quite say something like that, of this man's unbelievable arrogance. But also, I think it's a measure of his injury, of how much needs to be redressed in his mind. At one point, Ishmael begins to meditate about this and realizes the extent to which this whale is, in a sense, the kind of focusing fact of Ahab's life, that it's a weird kind of affective economy, that everything, because of the whale, comes together. I'll quote this too. All evil to crazy Ahab were visibly personified and made practically assailable in Moby Dick. In other words, it's like he unites all of the evil of the world as the kind of emblem of it. He placed upon the whale's white hump the sum of all the general rage and hate felt by his whole race from Adam down. Biblical reference, a sense in which all of the terrible things that have been recorded in humanity from the beginning of time, all of them are in some sense encapsulated in the body of this beast, and therefore he must be struck. And then that line goes, and then, as if his chest had been a mortar, he burst his hot heart's shell upon it. I don't even know how you take the measure of a metaphor like that. I mean, this is totally sort of sui generis, created by Melville. As if his chest had been a mortar, he burst his hot heart's shell upon it. It almost has a scary echo of suicide bomber. It's as if you are a living incendiary, you are a living weapon, munitions. And that's probably the way Ahab sees himself, that he is the counterweapon to this force of evil that is embodied in the white whale. Well, that says something about, again, I think the reach of Melville's own eloquence in finding the right figures and metaphors and tropes to measure the sort of grandeur, or perhaps madness, of this venture. In mapping out Ahab, and I'm using that word mapping out intentionally because it often looks like a map, Melville creates a kind of archaeology of the soul. It's as if the soul were a kind of layered edifice and that you explore it, predictably, by going further and further downward. So the map is one thing, that's the surface, but the map then sends you underneath the surface as well so that you constantly go deeper and deeper and deeper. And this leads Ishmael to reflect on Ahab's mania, and he suggests something quite interesting, it seems to me, which is that Ahab's obsession, his madness, has hijacked his personality. It's usurped his mind and his feelings, and it's reorganized them. It's concentrated them. It's distilled them so that it makes for a kind of frighteningly cogent figure. Everything, of course, is now in the form of this beast that must be slain. But in continuing with my remark about depth, that in a kind of spellbinding passage, we get a sense of Ahab's madness as only being a kind of surface. And this surface is compared to something that nobody else except Melville ever would have come up with, which is the Hôtel de Cluny in Paris. I don't know if you've been to Paris, and it's at the corner of Saint-Germain and Saint-Michel, and it's a medieval building. And we know that underneath it, because you can visit them, are these Roman thermal ruins. And that's the kind of depth image that Melville is getting at for Ahab, that underneath the surface of what you see of this wild madman, you have to go still further down if you are to explore him. And there, as you go further, you find these buried Roman ruins, and among these ruins, you find the torsos of statues, the broken thrones and captive kings. And he says that here then, in the depths, we find these emblems and icons that would figure forth Ahab. Again, it's the characteristic directionality of this book. That notion of the sort of cogency or control of the mind being hijacked is one of Melville's more interesting insights, it seems to me, because it challenges any kind of ownership that we might have. And it's in line, I think, really closer with modern psychology and the kinds of psychiatric disorders that we can have that are of no one's doing. They have to do with things that go wrong in our system neurologically, or perhaps because of experiences that we've had. But selfhood and ownership are in trouble in this text. And obsession becomes the gauge of when we start to lose control of ourselves, not just of our feelings, that madness becomes quite literally a form of alienation here. And then you get the question, and the book asks it quite specifically, is I, not E-Y-E, but I, the pronoun, is it an agent of our own volition? That's what we want to think. And when I say, I'm going to give this lecture, or I'm going to listen to this lecture, or I'm going to go to town, or I'm going to turn off this lecture, we think of ourselves as the originators of that phrase. But in this text, he leads us to consider whether or not I is simply an instrument of something else that is driving. This is not entirely, I think, different from Freud's model of the unconscious, that there's something within us that we have no access to and that essentially directs our pulsions or our needs and that we might live an entire life and never really shed light on it. There are a lot of pages devoted to trying to describe and invoke Ahab's peculiar mania. One of the most beautiful images that he gives is that he compares it to a vulture that feeds on the heart. Of course, this obviously evokes Prometheus, but he also compares it to a Catskill eagle, a particular Catskill eagle that is known for diving into the gorges. And there again, you have that depth going down, probing, sounding. But then he wonderfully writes that a Catskill eagle that dives into the gorges, no matter how far down it goes, is still awfully high up. And so that you're not simply down, but you're also high at the same time. Well, Ahab has a counterpart in this book, and it's not Ishmael. Ishmael is sort of our conduit, our guide. The counterpart is really his opposite number, and we will ultimately, I think, have to begin to think that it's his alter ego, and that's the little black cabin boy, Pip. And in a scene of remarkable beauty, Pip falls overboard. You're talking about going down. He goes down. He goes to the bottom. He goes to the bottom. He's carried alive down to the bottom and sees what there is to see there. The teeming undersea life, its immensity, its variety, its indifference. One could say that he has bottomed out. And what Melville writes is, he saw God's foot upon the treadle of the loom and spoke it, and therefore his shipmates called him mad. Ahab constantly observes Pip, feels that Pip is in a sense his sibling, his alter ego, that Pip is his other. Obviously, from any social or physical point of view, you know, they couldn't be more unlike each other. Now, Pip has been vacated, it seems to me. Pip has been emptied of his rationality, of his mind. He has very few powerful passages, though he has one I'm going to come to in a minute. But I want to return to Ahab. It's unmistakable that Ahab sort of exhibits a kind of megalomania, a single-mindedness, an obsessiveness. And I think Melville is out to show us the solipsism of this posture, the tunnel vision of all obsession and mania, that what it achieves in depth and intensity and perhaps even in truth, it pays the price for being cut off from others and from the world. And what the book makes us see, and for me it's surprising, I hadn't really anticipated this, but and I know it to be historically true, by the way, is that these ships in the 19th century that made these voyages for months and months and months, this is not at all as solitary as you might think. They frequently crossed other ships. They exchanged greetings. They exchanged mail. People could even change from ship to ship and go somewhere else. There is a kind of strange, attenuated, but nonetheless real society of ships on the waters. And so the Pequod meets a number of other ships in this novel. And what is intriguing, because Melville goes out of his way to underscore it, is that it gives us a chance to measure once again the obsessiveness, the solipsism, the alienation of Ahab, because he's only got one question. Hast seen the white whale? He doesn't even say, hast thou? Hast seen the white whale? That's what he wants to know over and over and over. Whereas Melville, with considerable wit, gives us a lot of information about some of these other sea captains. In one case, they board the ship, and these people are garrulous fellows, and they want to talk and chat and joke, and Ahab is just sitting there raging. All he wants to do is garner information about Moby Dick. So I think it's Melville's way of showing just what you pay in socialness, in sociability, really in humanity, by being hijacked like this for your obsessions. There's still another way, which is quite bizarre, that Melville enlists to display the monomania, now I'm going to use a particular word, but you'll see why, the cyclopic vision of Ahab. And that is the whale itself, because the book goes out of its way to show us that whales have eyes on the sides of their head, not the way human beings are made, with two eyes that are largely in the front of our head. And this means that the whale cannot see in front of itself, but unlike humans, it can see on both sides. And there's some wonderful paragraphs devoted to that about the peculiar ocular vision of the whale, but it's also a splendid image, it seems to me, of double vision itself, as opposed to the monocular vision, the cyclopic vision, the one-eyed vision of Ahab. I want to segue from there into the argument that I believe this book is meant to be stereophonic. And of course, that's one of the reasons that we have Ishmael. We have Ishmael as our guide. We have Ahab as the towering, domineering, autocratic figure who really, I think, takes over so much of the book. And then we have other characters from whom we hear a certain amount, particularly the mates, Starbuck, and also Stubb and Flask, the second and third mate. And in one of the later passages, it's as if Melville elected to dramatize, almost in theatrical terms, the multiplicity of perspectives that these people give us. All of this is in contrast to Ahab's single-minded vision. And so that's the chapter called The Doubloon, where they put this doubloon coin and they post it on a post. And then in kind of really a very schematic way, Melville tells us what each of the major characters thinks as he looks at this doubloon. They all examine it, and then Melville treats us to their thoughts. Before getting into that, I mean, let's just recognize that a doubloon, a coin, is one of the great semiotic items in the world. Money is a semiotic launchpad. I mean, after all, a bill is not worth very much intrinsically, but it's worth whatever you want it to be in terms of its buying power, in terms of the fantasies that it elicits in the people who crave it, who want to have it, who've lost it. So that money has always been something that sends you somewhere else, that is worth what you could do with it. In fact, this was Marx's critique of money, or at least among his critiques of money. So it's not surprising that you'd have this doubloon as the kind of sounding board or the trampoline from which these people are going to go into their particular visions. Ahab looks at it, and for him, it references the kind of coming storm, all of the turmoil of his life. Starbuck, who is the pious figure on the boat, looks at it and thinks that he can see the Trinity in it. Stubb looks at it, and he thinks about all the things he could buy with this money. He also has a hysterical sequence where it reminds him somehow of astrology, and he goes through all of the astrological figures and signs. Flask looks at it. He's the most prosaic of the group, and he thinks of how many cigars he might be able to buy with it. Others do as well. Queequeg looks at it. And then finally, Pip, the vacated child, the child who is an idiot, who has seen the foot of God in the deeps of the sea, and he's looking at it, and when he looks at it, Ahab looks at him. Ahab wants to know, what is this child who is, in a sense, his alter ego? What is he going to make of it? And he hears Pip talking, and this is what Pip says. I look, You look, he looks, we look, ye look, they look. It's the kind of thing that all of us have gone through when we learn a foreign language. It's like he takes all of the first, second, third, and plural persons and says, looking. This is what the erased Pip, because he's been vacated mentally, he occupies every subject position grammatically here about looking. It's a kind of grammar of interpretation as a madhouse, fruitless looking. We look from every different angle, and what do we find? And this is what Pip says. Here's the ship's navel, this doubloon here, and they are all on fire to unscrew it. But unscrew your navel, and what's the consequence? It's a marvelous line, because if you unscrew your navel, the saying has, your butt falls off, or perhaps your genitals as well. And it's enlisted here as a kind of continuation of this looking from every angle, this sort of interpretive model here, that madness might lie that way as well. Well, I've talked about Ahab, and I've talked about the perspectival nature of the book. I want now to move to what I take to be the richest and most prophetic chapter in the novel. And it's not really, it's Ishmael, it's not Ahab. And it's a chapter that's called The Whiteness of the Whale. And I think it offers us the most provocative view that this book is going to give us of the makings of our world. And in the phrase that I just pronounced, the makings of our world, the word that has to be struck is our. Because what this passage is about is the collapse of any anthropocentric model, any notion that the world is constructed according to human design or human scale. You wouldn't think a chapter called The Whiteness of the Whale would do that. In this chapter, the first thing that Melville does is he explores and then he dismantles the familiar color scheme, which is in fact a semiotic scheme, a sign system, a symbol system that links white, the color white, to a whole host of traditional values that all of us essentially take for granted, values that could be spiritual or aesthetic or obviously racial. White, the innocence of brides. White, the benignity of age. White, one passage says, the white bear of the poles. White, the albatross, and you think about Coleridge's poem. White, the white steed of the prairies, which is a figure of myth. White as death on a pale horse. When Melville wrote his review of Hawthorne, he wrote about the power of blackness, and we know that black has also an extraordinary history. Blackness represents for most of us, in traditional terms, evil. Melville understood that these terms are all arbitrary. They're all signs. They're part of a kind of large network. The history that colors have had is quite a history. Could you dismantle this sign system? Let me interject that Toni Morrison wrote a brilliant book recently about whiteness and blackness as signs, as having their own history, signs that imprison us within their own networks. Well, soon enough after the dismantling has been done so that we see these signs as, in a sense, arbitrary, loaded with symbolic values, but that coexisting with other completely different kinds of symbolic values, we realize that there may be something deeply histrionic here, theatrical. It's as if our symbolic schemes are in cahoots with some sort of illusory histrionic role of colors, and that they construe for us a world of value and variation and delineation and meaning. All of those are full words that I just used. Value, variation, delineation, meaning. That whole grocery list of analogs to white that I gave you, brides, age, the white bear, the albatross, all of those are full. All of those refer to possible meaning systems, signification systems. I started by telling you that this is the chapter that's the most prophetic chapter in the novel. It's the most interrogatory chapter of the novel Because what Melville is going to get to is that the ultimate thing that White points us to is nothing. Nothingness. Nullity. And I want to read you part of what I take to be the most spellbinding passage in the novel about the whiteness of the whale and what whiteness makes us think. He says that it shadows forth the heartless voids and immensities of the universe. Not the brilliant carnival of the universe, but the heartless voids and immensities of the universe, as if the universe were somehow dead, cold, stellar outer space. And he actually says that we get stabbed from behind when we look at white and think about white with the thought of annihilation. That it's some, I mean, this is again the Melvillian imagination, that it goes this far. This is what white is going to make him think. He says, that's what you feel if you look at the Milky Way, or at the white depths of the Milky Way. He says then that whiteness is not a color. It's rather the visible absence of color. As well, he says, as it being the concrete of all colors. And he's going to get to the term that he's looking for, which is blankness. Blankness. The blankness that he would see in a snow setting, in a polar setting. He calls it a colorless, all color of atheism from which we shrink. Whiteness is the erasure of meaning. To use a modern term that Melville wouldn't have used, whiteness is to open the door to a world of the absurd, where there's no pattern, no meaning, just blankness, just nothingness. It's there, but it doesn't mean anything. And then he's going to show us the sort of implications for our world if we think along these lines. And he's going to give us a wonderfully vivid image here of how colored our world is. The sweet tinges of sunset skies and woods, perfect romantic evocation. Yea, and the gilded velvets of butterflies. Again, a beautiful lyrical image of color. And watch where he goes from butterflies to the butterfly cheeks of young girls. And we think of our notion of carnal beauty, of human beauty, as having color. All these, he says, are but subtle deceits, not actually inherent in substances, but only laid on from without. So that all deified nature absolutely paints like the harlot, as if the natural world we see was just some sort of mascara, some made-up harlot figure, because underneath it there's nothing, whose allurements cover nothing but the charnel house within. This is almost a medieval picture, that the world you see of sumptuous, sensual, beautiful surfaces is a trap, a deceit. All there is the skeleton, and there's much medieval artwork like that. The skeleton, the memento mori, that there's nothing but death behind it all. But that won't stop Melville. He's not interested in some sort of moral statement here. He's interested in something more philosophical. He then is going to call light itself a kind of mystical cosmetic, staying with his imagery of the harlot, the painted harlot. The principle of light forever remains white or colorless in itself, and if operating without medium upon matter, would touch all objects, even tulips and roses, with its own blank tinge. In other words, in certain circumstances, white could be something that reduces the world to ashes. He says the palsied universe lies before us, a leper. That white, in a sense, derealizes the world. It makes us realize that all of the color, which we think of as the vibrancy of the setting that we live in, including ourselves, all of that is a fraud, it's illusory, it's a facade. White is what prompts that. It's one of the grand passages about the whiteness of the whale. It's what Moby Dick, at its most extreme, suggests. And I'm going to suggest something that Melville does not say, but that I think is consistent with Melville here, which is this operation of turning the world leprous is almost like a cannibalizing operation, that to look at surfaces and then to see through them, to look at human flesh and to see the skeleton behind it, this is what thinking is in Melville. This is what thinking does to the surface of the world. This is what it means when we look at things and we think and we reflect. You remember that passage about looking. I look, you look, he looks. That's what happens in this book, that obsessive thinking, obsessive speculation is something that scalps us in some sense. It turns us into nothing. It turns the world into nothing, into ash. This, I think, is the grand philosophical absurd conclusion that that passage leads to. It is fortunately not the way the book remains in our mind. The book remains in our mind as an enormously rich, fertile book that can contain even this. Thank you.